It's Friday, July 3rd. We're heading into a holiday weekend, but the news cycle isn't taking a break. Between the Fed's evolving stance on economic policy and the ongoing fallout from the Supreme Court's regulatory rulings, there's plenty to get through. We're also tracking a massive shift in how AI is actually impacting the labor market, and why the move fast and break things era is officially hitting a wall. Let's get into it. The Federal Reserve is changing how it does business. With Jerome Powell still at the helm, the central bank is signaling a move away from the broad-based and inclusive policy regime it adopted back in 2020. The Fed is now prioritizing price stability over explicit employment targets, which honestly is a significant shift in philosophy. The logic here is that by narrowing its focus to inflation, the Fed is trying to avoid the trap of using blunt interest rate tools to solve what are actually structural labor market issues. Here's why that matters. By dropping the official focus on maximum employment, the Fed is making its decision-making process significantly less transparent. When a central bank stops telling you exactly what its thresholds for success are, you're left in a vacuum where everyone, from business owners to your average worker, has to guess when the Fed might pull the lever. It also signals a return to a narrower interpretation of what the Fed is actually supposed to do, essentially telling the public that social issues like housing or regional economic disparities are no longer under their jurisdiction. If the labor market tanks, the Fed might just sit on its hands to protect price stability, shifting the entire burden of managing the economy onto fiscal policy. That's a gamble, and it's one that could make future recessions longer and deeper. Moving over to the UK, Nigel Farage is running into a bit of a complexity trap. Farage has been building a brand as a man of the people, but his actual financial life, which includes high-paying roles as a brand ambassador for gold and crypto interests, alongside some pretty opaque property holdings, is starting to look like the exact type of establishment elitism he usually attacks. While he isn't breaking parliamentary rules, the optics are beginning to take a toll on his electoral base. According to analysis by More in Common, the secondary tier of Reform UK voters, the ones looking for a pragmatic alternative to the establishment, are getting skeptical. The political reality is that once you're seen as just another wealthy career politician, that outsider brand loses its teeth. It puts the party in a precarious spot, because Farage's brand is so singular that there's no clear successor if he were forced to step aside. If he's forced into a by-election over that ongoing £5 million crypto donation inquiry, it could be an existential moment for his movement. British voters are currently signaling a preference for stability, and right now, Farage is looking like a source of constant high-stakes turbulence. Back here in the US, the Supreme Court has issued a series of rulings, most notably in Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo, that effectively end the Chevron deference doctrine. The court is stripping federal agencies of their autonomy by ruling that courts, not agencies, should interpret ambiguous statutes. This creates a massive governance problem. If an agency like the EPA or the Department of Education can't act without a specific granular statute, and Congress is too gridlocked to pass anything new, you end up with total policy stagnation. The court is also moving toward a colorblind interpretation of the 14th Amendment, which is systematically dismantling any policies meant to remediate past societal wrongs. We are moving into a much more volatile regulatory environment, where the president's influence over federal agencies is becoming absolute. And the only venue left for resolving major national issues is a legislature that, let's be honest, hasn't been working particularly well lately. Speaking of institutional failure, the fallout from the raid on the Marion County Record is still serving as a masterclass in why local journalism is the immune system of a democracy. What started as a local police attempt to squash reporting on corruption ended with a $3 million settlement and the resignation of the police chief. It's a classic case of the system failing to police itself. The local law enforcement and the judiciary were both involved in bypassing constitutional protections, and the only reason the truth came out was because of outside scrutiny. It's a grim reminder that accountability in small towns is often non-existent until an external force shows up to save the day. The tech sector is finally finding out that you can't just treat the labor market like a beta test. the narrative around AI and employment is finally starting to shift. For a while, the conversation was almost exclusively about how many jobs AI would kill. But the data, specifically from companies like Ramp and Box, is showing that businesses aggressively adopting AI are actually growing their headcount by 10% to 12% annually, compared to flat growth for those that aren't. Here's the thing, AI isn't acting as a replacement for human labor. It's acting as a multiplier. Firms that integrate these tools go through a 6 to 12 month learning curve, but once they're over that hump, the increased output requires more people to manage the systems, not fewer. That said, it's not all sunshine. We're seeing a massive and frankly predictable divide. Companies that treat AI as a blunt cost-cutting tool are running into a wall. They slash staff, realize the quality of their work craters, and then have to scramble to rehire experts to fix the mess. It turns out AI is a tool for leverage, not a substitute for knowing what the hell you're doing. And the stakes are moving beyond the boardroom. We're seeing a shift toward interventionist policy. China is already setting precedents that force companies to justify layoffs in court, based on worker protection. And there's talk in Western economies about everything from state equity stakes to penalties for displacement. Basically, the era of move fast and break things is hitting the regulatory reality wall, which, honestly, is about time. You can't just treat the labor market like a beta test without expecting some kind of political blowback. Along with that shift in labor, we're seeing a change in how we actually use these tools. We're moving away from the one-size-fits-all model. Anthropic's release of Sonnet 3.5 is a perfect example. It's positioning itself as a high-performance daily driver that handles agent tasks at a lower cost than the massive frontier models. The strategy now is to reserve the expensive high-stakes models for specialized work, while offloading routine, daily agent loops to more efficient, tiered options. The AI office is also leaving the desktop. With new mobile apps for tools like Claude and Cursor, plus direct financial integrations, developers can now monitor deployments and analyze data from their phones. It's creating a constant, asynchronous feedback loop. You aren't waiting until you're back at a workstation to approve a blocker anymore. And with the new official integration for X, AI agents are now scouring social discourse as a structured data source in real time. It's changing how researchers and strategists work. They're basically offloading the scouring part of their job to agents that don't need coffee breaks. But if you look at the broader market, there's a serious fragility hidden under all this growth. The U.S. stock market's run this year has been heavily fueled by a tiny group of AI-focused companies and leaders. It's an infrastructure build, semiconductors and memory, but it's highly concentrated. We're seeing key man risk across the board. If a company like OpenAI or Anthropic hits a major regulatory or operational snag, the whole sector could see a pretty violent correction. The takeaway here is pretty clear. The AI as a promise phase is over. We're in the AI as a discipline phase now. The companies that survive the next year aren't the ones just burning cash on compute. They're the ones securing their own energy, embedding their own experts, and actually figuring out how to grow the pie instead of just trying to shrink their payrolls. If this year has taught us anything, it's that the market is a lot more fragile than the hype suggests. We'll see who's still standing when the liquidity tests actually hit. Maryland is taking over its racetrack operations. The state has acquired the track's assets and intellectual property, effectively moving the sport from private sector control to a state-backed model. It's a massive move aimed at protecting a $3 billion economic engine that supports about 30,000 jobs. The goal is simple: long-term stability. It's a necessary shift, honestly, because the current model is falling apart. We've seen a string of heat waves across the Midwest and East Coast lately, which forced a wave of race cancellations. It turns out that relying on outdoor conditions in an era of climate instability is a pretty shitty business plan. The industry is reacting by consolidating. We're seeing a clear split for everyone involved. Smaller, aging venues are struggling, while the money and the talent are gravitating toward anchor circuits like Saratoga. If you're a trainer or an owner, the regional circuit isn't cutting it anymore. You have to be at the major hubs to survive. It's a go big or go home situation that's forcing a much more professional, data-driven approach to the sport. Which is just a polite way of saying, the days of the local, decentralized track are numbered. In the NBA, front offices are currently prioritizing short-term talent over structural integrity. Reports indicate the Philadelphia 76ers are pursuing high-profile targets like Paul George, while teams like the Lakers are aggressively trading draft capital for immediate roster upgrades. These moves are a gamble on immediate relevance, often at the expense of long-term cap flexibility or developing young cores. It's a high-variance strategy that suggests teams are feeling immense pressure to win now, even when the math behind these massive contracts doesn't always add up. The media industry is having a rough go of it too. Comcast is officially pulling the plug on its 15-year experiment with vertical integration. The company is spinning off its cable networks, effectively splitting NBC Universal away from its connectivity business. This leaves NBC Universal to sink or swim as a standalone media entity, which honestly is just a polite way of saying it's being dressed up for an eventual sale. The conventional wisdom is that NBC Universal will either go on a shopping spree or get bought out, but that's a false binary. The smart money says it's a sequence. They'll buy up smaller assets to inflate their valuation, then look for a tech-focused suitor. And let's be clear, no one is looking at their legacy linear TV assets as the crown jewels. A buyer like Netflix doesn't want the headaches of regulatory hurdles or the political friction that comes with cable. They want the NFL production rights and the kids' franchises. Everything else is just a liability on the balance sheet. It's the same story playing out across the entire media landscape, really. We're watching the death of the generalist. If you're running a newsletter or a media brand based on taste or just aggregating the news, you're in trouble. The data shows that unless your content functions as a tangible service, think proprietary finance data or specialized investing frameworks, the churn rate is going to eat you alive. If an LLM can replicate your output, you're basically just waiting to be deleted from someone's inbox. The only thing keeping people paying these days is niche expertise and, more importantly, community. We're moving toward what people are calling tiny internets. It's not about hosting massive high-overhead events to prove how big your reach is. It's about building structures where your audience can actually talk to each other. Content gets them in the door, but community is the only thing that keeps them from leaving when the next shiny thing pops up. If you aren't transitioning from a content provider to a platform for affinity, your days are numbered. This shift toward fragmentation isn't just happening in newsletters. It's completely rewiring how political campaigns operate. Candidates are straight up ghosting the mainstream media. They've realized that the traditional press, with its pesky adversarial questioning and fact-checking, is a net negative for their brand. Instead, they're choosing to go direct. They're jumping on podcasts and streaming platforms where the environment is friendly, the audience is already ideologically aligned, and they can control every single frame of the narrative. Look at the playbook being used by various campaigns. They are trying to win over a skeptical editorial board. They're producing highly polished, bite-sized clips designed specifically to go viral. They're trading the scrutiny of a real interview for the engagement metrics of a TikTok feed. It's a cleaner, faster way to move the needle, and it effectively turns the campaign trail into a content studio. The irony here is that the news organizations themselves are chasing the same dragon. When you see places like the New York Times or The Athletic prioritizing personalities who can drive subscriptions, they're essentially adopting the same influencer-first model as the politicians. It creates this weird systemic tension where the reporter is no longer just a reporter. They're a brand manager. They're incentivized to chase the click, protect their access, and build a personal following, because that's where the pay scale is now. It's a shitty feedback loop. The politicians want to be influencers to avoid accountability, and the reporters are being forced to become influencers to keep their jobs. When everyone is just playing for the algorithm, the actual work of digging into policy or holding power to account becomes a lot harder to find. It's not a shift in the landscape. It's a total abandonment of the old guard. And we're all just living in the aftermath. And lastly, a few other things worth knowing this morning. First, Phil Mickelson has lost his memberships at private clubs like the Farms and the Madison Club. It turns out that even in the world of high-end golf, being a headache for the board has consequences. In Chicago, the Obama Presidential Center is doing exactly what critics feared, turning the surrounding Woodlawn neighborhood into a playground for investors. Real estate speculation has driven median home prices up nearly fivefold, which, honestly, is a hell of a way to celebrate civic investment. It's a classic case of a shiny new project pricing out the people who actually live there. Over at the Supreme Court, the justices are proving they aren't quite the puppets some folks want them to be. Their legal philosophy is rooted in a pre-Trump era that's deeply skeptical of broad executive power, which means they're just as likely to block a Republican president as a Democrat. It's a reminder that institutional momentum is a bitch to stop, even when you're the one holding the gavel. And finally, the distributor Neon just picked up a film about OpenAI, and it's pretty clear they aren't looking for a cinematic masterpiece. They're chasing the awards buzz and the inevitable PR firestorm that comes with anything AI-related. It's a bargain bin strategy. Buy the controversy, let the internet do the marketing, and hope the script is at least coherent enough to get a screen at Sundance. That's the morning briefing. Enjoy the holiday weekend, and I'll see you back here on Monday.